Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And this week, Lahav, it's Sukkot here in Israel. I don't know where you were for the first days of the holiday, but where I was in the center of the country, we were not home in Jerusalem, which usually gets that cool air definitely at night, but we were in the center. And let me tell you, it's hot. It's not easy sitting in the sukkah when it's humid and you're schwitzing inside at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I just moved. I'll just tell people I moved from Tel Aviv to what could be considered a suburb of Jerusalem, I guess. And definitely much better air here in the sukkah, although having lunch in the sukkah was about the same. It's only in the evening, but it's, you know what, the weather here is so much better than what I remember growing up in the Northeast, although I know right now they're having similar weather to us, but we would have these days where you could only say, I mean, you grew up in Chicago, it's probably even worse, you know, where you could only say Kiddush in the Sukkah and then you have to run inside. So I'm grateful for having nice Sukkot weather.
Oh, no, for sure. Listen, growing up in Chicago, probably out of a week-long holiday, we would only sit partial meals, if at all, in a sukkah. You would probably just make kiddush, and then you'd go inside. And if you were lucky to get to the soup or the meatballs in the sukkah, that was considered a big accomplishment. Definitely depends on when the holiday falls out. But, you know, as the country kind of winds down to an extent, and Sukkot is obviously a national holiday when people are off, and the government also slows down a bit, but there's still a lot going on. Next week, you're off again to the United States with the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, this time, though, not to Washington. He was there just a few weeks ago meeting with President Joe Biden and his top staff. But this time he's going to the United Nations, where he will be delivering his first address at the General Assembly as Prime Minister. And that's a big deal, right? That's the first time Israelis will be seeing someone who is not Netanyahu over the last 12, 13 years standing at the United Nations podium. So tell us what the significance is of that visit and that speech that he's going to be giving.
Well, for the sake of accuracy, I will say that one year Foreign Minister Yisrael Katz spoke, but it was not such a big event. Let's put it that way.
You see, it was so big and so monumental that I remember.
Right, exactly. But Bennett, you know, I think you're right to frame it as what have Israelis seen in the last decade, because I think that this is a trip that is really meant for domestic consumption. You know, yes, the eyes of the world are watching the UN, and Bennett will say things that are supposed to make an impression on the world. But I think overall, he is trying to make an impression on Israelis, to say that he, too, can be a player on the world stage. He, too, can give a powerful speech in English and stand up for Israel and stand up for Israel's security in front of the whole world. You know, and when he's standing in front of that green marble wall, and Israelis will see that on TV and in their newspapers, then it will make, I think it will likely make a strong impression. I don't know if it's going to really win them over one way or another, but I think that it'll make a strong impression. Certainly that he's capable and that he's a player.
Yeah, I could tell you that speaking to some people in his office early on, just when they took office back in June, and they were looking at the calendar and saw that the available date for him to speak would fall out on Sukkot, and it requires him to actually remain in New York over the holiday of Simchat Torah and not to be able to fly back to Israel. To them, you know, I don't know if Netanyahu would have had a question, should he go, should he not go, if a different prime minister would have thought maybe, you know, rather stay in Israel for the holiday or whatever it is. But to them, there was no question that he has to be there, because it's part of this, I would say, campaign or effort on his part that he has to try to show Israelis that he can do the things that Netanyahu did, right? He could sit in the Oval Office next to a president and have a good relationship and get things done. He can go to the United Nations and have a speech that will also impress Israelis. So a lot of that is also, like you said, for the domestic consumption of Israelis.
Yeah. And, you know, you were mentioning that Bennett's going to be in New York over the holiday. So I know when we were in Washington and we were stuck, we ended up being delayed and we were stuck in Washington over Shabbat. People really, really loved reading that story. This time it's going to be a lot less dramatic because we are no longer in a COVID bubble. Everyone on the trip has to have gotten their booster shot. And if you get your booster shot, you don't have to be in quarantine when you return to Israel. So we're all left to our own devices. Plus, you know, there's endless kosher food in New York. So that part's going
right,
to be...
Right, so you won't have to...
Yeah, I mean...
You won't need the embassy this time to take care of food for you.
Right, exactly. And we're not all staying in the same hotel. So it's going to take some real sleuthing to find out where Bennett is going to shul that morning.
If he goes to shul, Lahav.
Yeah, I know. I'm joking.
But a question, though, about the speech itself. Is there any indication that you're getting... from within his office of what the content will be, what's his focus going to be on? Is he going to do, you in previous years have I think it was, we did it online or on your Twitter feed, like a bingo game of what trick or what shtick Netanyahu would bring to the UN, right? He's known for moments of silence and staring at delegates. He's known for showing cartoons of bombs and things like that, or bringing even drone parts to, that wasn't to the UN, but that was to a talk in Munich. Do we have an indication if Bennett's going to be doing that, or he's just going to be giving a straight up speech focusing on Iran, let's say? Do we have any idea?
There are certain things that Bennett prefers to focus on more as opposed to other things. So if he says the word Palestinians in his entire speech, I'll be very surprised. Bennett, from the beginning of his political career, has believed, you know, Israel has a lot to offer the world and that we should sort of shift focus away from Palestinians and things like that. So I think that that's, first of all, going to be like his principle going in. But he might talk about Hamas. I do think, though, the emphasis will very much be Iran, Iran's nuclear program. Time is really of the essence right now when it comes to Iran, because they are using this sort of break in nuclear talks, which, of course, they initiated the break, but they're using it to advance their program. And you know, there's a lot of concern in Israel, but also in Washington and in Paris and in London. So that's going to be a big part of it. I think that also Bennett's going to talk about peace and Israel having better relations with its neighbors in the region and really trying to emphasize that. It's interesting to bring that up at the UN. I'm not saying he shouldn't bring it up in the UN, but you know, all of our new partners in the Middle East, they're still not very helpful to us in the UN, which is, of course, always the irony. There are so many countries that we have improved relations with, or we have new relations with, but somehow in the UN, we can never cut a break.
Right. So it'll definitely be a speech that's worth watching, and that speech is going to be on Monday, right? Am I correct?
Yes, it's going to be Monday. It's supposed to be Monday morning, and then, which is like late afternoon in Israel. I think Bennett will hope very strongly that it'll happen before the holiday begins in Israel, but he might end up with the same problem he had at the White House, which is that it was scheduled to begin before the holiday so that religious people could see his meeting with Biden before the holiday. But in the end, it went over late.
Right.
So we'll have to wait and see.
Before Shabbat, that was back in Washington.
Right.
And here it's right. Monday evening starts the holiday of Simchat Torah.
Right.
So we'll have to wait to see how that plays out. Lahav, one other topic, which is interesting, that happened just the other night was when Biden, right, in his meeting with Prime Minister Bennett, made a promise that they would replenish Israeli interceptors for the Iron Dome after the operation called Guardian of the Walls. Yes, that was the name of the operation. They need to come up with better names for future operations if there are to be. But put that aside for a moment.
Don't pick up their names from Game of Thrones.
Yes. Lots of Iron Domes obviously were used. This cost about $1 billion. The U.S. administration had said that it would give that money. It seemed to have the support of the House, of the Senate, Congress. And it's supposed to come up for a vote. And House Democrats from the progressive flank of the party started to oppose and resist that that part of the bill that was going to be put forward, and the party had to pull it out of the bill, and that did not pass. They're talking about how it will be part of a defense budget, but this is something that I think is kind of an alarm, right? We saw a lot of Democrats who came out, those who are more supportive of Israel, were very critical of their progressive colleagues. We saw AIPAC put out a very harsh statement, which is not usually its tone, although that's changed a bit recently. So what does this mean for Israeli U.S. ties, Israeli Democratic Party ties? How concerned should we be about this?
So you have people on different sides sort of either trying to really inflate this into a huge crisis, which is, you generally get that from the right and from Republicans. And then you have Israeli officials, you know, like Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, were saying, oh, it's just a technical matter, it's okay. And I think if we take this in proportion, it's somewhere in between those. It's not just a technical issue. Even though, you know, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said he's going to bring up a bill that's just the Iron Dome within a week, and so it'll probably pass very quickly. And that is what Israel needs right now. We want those Iron Dome batteries as soon as possible, because we are still getting attacked by Hamas in Gaza, even if it's not, you know, at a wartime level. So the technical problem has been solved, but the problem is bigger than a technical problem. The influence of the progressive flank in the Democratic Party is growing. They're highly critical of Israel. Beyond this thing that happened yesterday, which some of the prime minister's office called it a trick, that progressives played a trick. And I also think that maybe that word minimizes it a little. I think it's a strategy. But beyond this thing that the progressives did, you know, this week, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, known as AOC, she's also proposed a bill that lumps Israel together with major human rights violators and says that, you know, we shouldn't get certain weapons. We shouldn't be able to buy certain weapons from the U.S. So I think that this is a push that's going to continue from the quote unquote squad. And then there's always a handful of a few sort of older members of Congress who have continuously been anti-Israel as well. And I think that's something that Israel needs to really watch out for. Now,
sure.
President Biden is not the squad. You know, he's not that far on the left. In fact, he was probably the most pro-Israel candidate of all running in the primary. But he is definitely susceptible to pressure from within his party. And you can see the House leadership. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, I think, is very pro-Israel, but, you know, clearly susceptible to this kind of pressure. They just didn't have the votes. And these things will happen again and again.
Right. But I think also you see here, Lahav, the generational shift, right?
Yeah.
You know, Steny Hoyer, if I'm not mistaken, is 81 or 82. Nancy Pelosi is probably late 70s, if not 80 already. Chuck Schumer, who's the Senate Majority Leader, is also in his 70s. Biden.
Chuck Schumer, I have to say, off-record Israeli officials have said they're so disappointed in Chuck Schumer, who goes around telling everyone that he's Shomer Yisrael, you know, the guardian of Israel, but doesn't say anything. He barely said anything in May when there was a war going on. He hasn't said anything about this. Because of this pressure.
Right, because he's also concerned of what, correct, they're all concerned with the pressure, but the people who are the supposed pro-Israel flank within the party is this older crew, and they're moving out. Now, you do have younger people. We saw tweets that were coming out by Richie Torres and other members of Congress from the Democratic Party who were definitely much more favorable, but you do have this problem. And I'll tell you what struck me, right, is that Iron Dome is a consensus issue. It's something that is a defensive measure. It's a defensive tool. It's not an offensive weapon. It should be obvious that the United States wants to help protect the lives of citizens of an allied country like Israel. But the fact that Iron Dome becomes something that's so controversial is creating concern within the defense establishment, for example, within Benny Gantz's circle, because he's now trying to start negotiations with the Defense Department about a new MOU, a new memorandum of understanding for foreign military aid that would come into effect when this current deal comes to an end after 10 years. So that would be, yes, like 2026, 2027, but they would have to start negotiating for that now. And if this is the resistance that they're facing already on an issue that's so much in the consensus like Iron Dome, imagine what will happen with something that's really supposed to help Israel by fighter jets and attack helicopters and JDAM missile kits, etc. So that's something that's going to be much more difficult. And I'll just say one more thing about Iron Dome, which people tend to forget and ignore. And maybe this is a bit controversial, but Iron Dome, yes, of course, first and foremost, protects Israeli lives, right? It intercepts those rockets that Hamas and Islamic Jihad fire into Israeli cities, and that's huge. But what people don't understand is that if we didn't have Iron Dome, and you had thousands of rockets, like during the last round of violence in May, during Guardian of Walls, I think it was 4,000 or 5,000 rockets were fired into Israel. If those 4,000 or 5,000 rockets did not have a system like Iron Dome to intercept them, they would be falling on Israeli cities, and you'd have many more Israelis who would be killed, wounded, and and property destroyed, as opposed to, unfortunately, yes, a few Israelis died, but not tens, not dozens, not hundreds. If the numbers were different, Israel would have to go into Gaza in a much bigger way, and that would cause much more destruction in Gaza, many more casualties in Gaza, and many more people killed in Gaza. So Iron Dome actually doesn't just save Israeli lives, it saves also Palestinian lives, maybe even more Palestinian lives, right? And people don't understand that's the reality of what this system does. It saves lives on both sides of the border, and that's why, I'm sorry to say this, but that was just stupid and ignorant by the people who are trying to prevent that money from going through.
I actually think you're giving them too much credit by calling them stupid and ignorant, because I think that at this point, and you know, knowing the group of people who have been involved in this, it's intentional. I mean, they are against Israel, and they don't want Israel. You know, you look at someone like Rashida Tlaib, who doesn't want Israel to exist in the form that it exists right now. I mean, they don't want there to be a Jewish state.
Right.
And, you know, they think that Israel is inherently a problem. So, you know, the fact that Iron Dome saves lives in Israel doesn't matter to them.
Doesn't matter.
I almost wish it was stupid and ignorant, because then you could teach them.
Correct.
Right? You could try to inform them. But I think it's...
No, this is just stupid, because it shows that even on something that's so obvious, they can manipulate it in a way that's not meant to be manipulated. But you're right. They're blinded by this hatred of Israel, and that just overtakes everything. Lahav, let's wish our listeners a continued Chag Sameach for Sukkot. You'll be in New York next week, so we'll tap in, hopefully, to what's happening with Bennett from there. I guess we'll record the podcast on the road. Next, we have an interview with Joel Rosenberg. So just one word about Joel, and this kind of ties into what we're talking about before. Joel is one of the evangelical leaders who actually lives in Israel. He's an American Israeli. He has a new book out called Enemies and Allies, which talks about the Abraham Accords and the realignment that's taking place in the Middle East. He's a best-selling author for books, mostly fiction writing, but has also written occasionally nonfiction. This book is specifically a nonfiction book that's out and that's new. But we also talked to Joel about Feast of the Tabernacles. The holiday of Sukkot is known as a holiday that brings together Christians and evangelicals to the state of Israel. And we spoke to him also about evangelical support for Israel, which recent studies have shown might be dropping and is not as profound as it once was. So stay tuned for an interesting interview with Joel Rosenberg. So it's a privilege to have with us Joel Rosenberg, who's a New York Times bestselling author, a prolific writer of commentary on the state of Israel and the region and the Middle East. We've had the opportunity at the Jerusalem Post to publish a number of op-eds by Joel over the years about his travels throughout the region to different Gulf states, Saudi, the United Arab Emirates. And we'll talk a bit about that later with regards to his new book, Enemies and Allies. But first, Joel, we thought we'd kind of tap into you for a moment. We're in the middle of the holiday of Sukkot here in Israel and across the Jewish world, of course. And this is a holiday that in recent years has very much become associated with Christian and evangelical support for the state of Israel. Well, many of us are familiar with the Feast of Tabernacles that takes place every year. Under COVID, I'm not sure exactly how that is last year or this year, but maybe you could kind of just give us some input into what is it about this holiday that brings the Christians to really express and illustrate their support for Israel.
Sure. Well, absolutely. Happy holidays to you both. And usually I'm in Israel celebrating Sukkot in our family sukkah. In fact, when we first made Aliyah 7 years ago, we built our sukkah. We were living in Netanya at the time, and we built our sukkah on the balcony. And I couldn't get any of the boys or my wife to sleep in it, but I tried. And then it was so painful being on the concrete, you know, balcony that I reread the scriptures about this. And it said every native born Israeli or Israelite, you know, needs to sleep in the sukkah. And I'm like, that's not me. I'm an immigrant. So I went back to bed in my house. You know, I try to take the Bible very literally, so it's good. So, look, I think that evangelicals have looked for ways to support Israel over the years. And to the credit of the International Christian Embassy Jerusalem, they put together an event basically welcoming Christians. At its peak, it was 4,000 to 5,000 pre-COVID evangelicals from all over the world coming and not only touring, but having a several day conference more recently in the basketball arena just outside of Jerusalem. And I think because it's a beautiful time of year, it's a beautiful time to, you know, it's a holiday time, but it's not the highest holiday from a few days ago with Yom Kippur and stuff. So it was sort of a, it made sense for Christians to come and just celebrate the fact that the God of Israel has brought Israel as a sovereign nation state back into existence after more than 1900 years, after many people's prayers, and after most people who don't believe in God thought it was absolutely ridiculous. God's never going to actually fulfill these prophecies. You're smoking crack if you think that there's really a God and he really is going to, you know, have a resurrection, as it were, of the nation state of Israel and bring the Jewish people literally back to the land and rebuild the ancient ruins and make the deserts bloom. But, you know, evangelicals believe this literally, and as do many Jews, though not, you know, not all. And so it's just a great time to celebrate and then to assess kind of what's coming next. How do we pray for the peace of Jerusalem? And for many years, we didn't see those prayers answered in terms of peace, but some things are really breaking through now.
In recent years, I think it's become, I guess, a little more controversial for Christians to be sort of adopting Jewish holidays. I know earlier this year during Passover, there was like a Facebook post that went viral of an evangelical woman holding a Passover Seder with a challah on her table. I see this sort of increasing resentment over these kinds of things. What do you respond to that?
Well, that's interesting. You would know better on the sort of the inside of the religious Jewish community in Israel and in the United States and elsewhere. Generally, I would say that the brand, as it were, I hate to use that term, but the brand evangelical has probably its highest and warmest appreciation in Israel in recent years. Because of just the consistent, unconditional love and standing with Israel through thick and thin, including obviously persuading Trump to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and you know, recognize the Golan Heights as sovereign Israeli territory, and rip up the Iran nuclear deal, and you know, put a maximum pressure campaign on Iran, and so on and so forth. Obviously, evangelicals have been coming to Israel even during the worst moments of bombing and terrorism, the suicide bombings, you know, of the Second Intifada. Evangelicals were some of the few people that would show up and continue to visit.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think this practice, though.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, I don't think Jewish people should be worried about Christians discovering and being fascinated with biblical holidays and biblical traditions. I think that's part of this deep love, which unfortunately, you know, I'm not trying to be mean to my Roman Catholic brothers and sisters, but it really wasn't a thing for the last, let's say, 1800 or 1900 years for Roman Catholicism to really teach, much less encourage people to understand where Jews, where Israel fits in the biblical narrative. And when you take out Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so forth from the whole Christian story, you run the risk of people thinking being very hostile towards Jews or indifferent, right? Mm-hmm. I'd prefer indifferent than hostile, but I'd prefer warmth and understanding and appreciation and solidarity. So you find a lot of Christians who just are excited about the Jewish roots of their faith. And of course, the Passover is such an important holiday. I think it's a good thing for Christians to learn about Pesach and to celebrate it. It's certainly for, you know, obviously for followers of Jesus, we believe that's, you know, sort of that Jesus himself was the Passover lamb in the new covenant era. But even setting the theological differences aside, it's important for us to understand, just as Jews are supposed to remind each other and our children and grandchildren, why was the Passover so important? What did that show us about God's mercy on us? I think Christians should know that, and celebrating it is a good thing.
So Joel, you're one of the more prominent evangelical figures today that kind of, I would say, straddles that Israel-U.S. relationship. And I'm curious, there was a study that came out a few months ago back in May, which kind of was surprising because we had always assumed, I guess, here in Israel, that to an extent there was all this talk about evangelical support, and especially under throughout the Trump years. And we saw that there was a study back in 2018 which spoke about over half of young evangelicals support the state of Israel. But then there was this survey that came out which showed that 700 evangelical Christians between the ages of 18 and 29, and they were asked where they placed their support in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. 33% said Israel, 24% said the Palestinians. And this was a big break from 2018, when you had about 70% of young evangelicals who were responding on the same question that they side with Israel. So is there a trend that's changing here? Are the numbers screwed? Are they not the right way? I mean, like, how do you understand what's happening?
Sure. Well, it's a good question, Yaakov. I actually was part of the funding of that first study from 2017, 2018, that did the initial sort of benchmark. Where are we? Because anecdotally, we were hearing that young evangelicals were turning away or against, away from or against Israel. That study, as you're citing accurately, didn't indicate that evangelicals, young people, were against Israel, but they were moving into the I don't know what I think category compared to their parents and grandparents. Now, what we're finding is, you know, you add a cut 4 or 5 more years to that, and that trend is continuing. So that's a problem. And it's a problem for Israel, but it's a problem of evangelical Christianity, that we're not doing a good enough job educating young people because we're sort of assuming that our team gets it because so much of the team has gotten it post 1948 in a way that, the previous 1900 years weren't so good. That's broadly speaking. But so it's a problem. Now, again, even the recent study isn't showing so much that young evangelicals are turning against. They're mostly saying, I support Palestinians too. And I don't think that's necessarily bad, but let me explain briefly why. You know, I believe that that one of the problems in modern Christian Zionism is that it's so pro-Israel, but which I'm for that part, but it often doesn't speak at all about Palestinians, or speaks very derogatorily, or, you know, really denigrates or demeans the Palestinian people. Now, and that's from some of the most prominent Christian Zionist leaders. Now, I understand they're sort of rooting for their team and they're sort of rooting against the other team if it were, let's say, a soccer match. Okay. But the problem is that God loves Palestinians. There's nothing in the Bible that says God doesn't love these people or want a good plan for them. And I think, And a lot of what I do, especially with our new websites, All Israel News and All Arab News, is say, listen, we evangelicals should be for the human rights and the civil rights of Palestinians. That doesn't mean that we don't believe that Israel has a right to security and land, but we ought to be more forward leaning in defending the rights of Palestinians to have a healthy life, you know, that liberate Gaza, not from Israel, but from Hamas, right? Liberate the Palestinians in the West Bank, or we would say Judea and Samaria, but not primarily from Israel. Their main problem is from the corrupt Palestinian Authority, who won't make a deal no matter who makes it, what's the offer, what's the terms. They just never say yes. And I think at some point you have to say, I'm not sure that's Israel's problem as much as it is the leadership of the Palestinians. So I think Christian Zionism has mistakenly not shown compassion for Palestinians. And I think that's showing up in young evangelicals who feel like it's a little tilted unfairly. I'm not saying there isn't a liberal drift against Israel. I think there is some of that, but I think some of it is just, how shouldn't we be for this underdog also? And I think the answer is yes.
I don't think it has to do, though, with honestly politics on both sides in America. But what's relevant to evangelicals is more Republicans sort of drifting in a more isolationist direction, whether it comes to, you know, aid to other countries, but also just involvement in other countries' affairs.
I wouldn't characterize it quite that way, Lahav. I think that Republicans generally have been quite engaged in the world, particularly in the Middle East. What we're concerned about right now is Biden's full-on retreat. But to your deeper point, I think the tribalization of the Republican Party being so pro-Trump, and Trump means pro-Israel. And so if you're pro-Israel, you're pro-Trump. And if you're pro-Trump, you're pro-Israel. For young evangelicals who didn't like Trump, and in fact, in many ways, you know, couldn't stand him, then that became a problem, because now Israel was tied together with an American political official whom they couldn't stand, right? And so now you had, and of course, Netanyahu, we would say bless his heart in evangelicalism, like, was so pro-Trump and became essentially a Republican Israeli premier rather than bipartisan. It was easy to do. I understand why he did it, but that caused a problem also. And
on the point of Netanyahu, Joel, we saw after the new government by Benin and Lapid was formed, another evangelical high profile leader, Mike Evans, came out and was extremely critical of the fact that the Israeli people were allowing this new government to come together and that Netanyahu was being ousted from office. He was very much aligned, like you and Lahav were both just saying, with the Republican Party, with the more conservative approach, not just to U.S. politics, but also to Israeli policies. How much of his departure changes now the dynamic of the relationship between Israel and evangelicals, or does not change it at all?
Well, I've always considered myself a friend of Mike Evans, but he had a political meltdown in which he lost Trump as, you know, as a leader. He lost Netanyahu, his dear friend of some 40 years, as a leader. And then Facebook took his page down. And I think it didn't go well for him. But his denunciation, and in such vitriolic language, even obscene language, actually, which we broke the story at All Israel News, was completely wrong. It was not Christian. And what he said was that 100% of evangelicals would turn against Naftali Bennett. That's just crazy talk. That's not true. And what the good thing that came out of that, as you guys reported, we reported, others, was that not only was that not true, but what Evans did was force out every evangelical leader to say, no, our support and our love for Israel is unconditional. It's not based on who's in power on Balfour Street. It's based on the Bible. And so we love Netanyahu, his strengths. We know he has some weaknesses. But we'll support Israel, whether it's Bennett or Lapid. We may have policy differences with some of them. So, but yes, this is the challenge that then Naftali Bennett really, I think, skillfully navigated, I would say to his credit, when he came to Washington a few weeks ago and met with Biden, right? Because you had the whole surrender of Afghanistan and that whole brouhaha, and that was a really difficult moment. I would not have wanted to see Prime Minister Netanyahu in the Oval Office at that moment, because I'm not sure he could have restrained himself from being critical. And there was a lot to criticize Biden, but not by an Israeli prime minister. Bennett did the right thing. He stood with his ally. He gave condolences for the losses of the American soldiers killed in the suicide bombing. And he's really trying to reinvigorate the bipartisan nature of American support. And Biden, let's be honest, I'm critical about Biden on Iran, on Afghanistan, but he's the most pro-Israel Democrat that there is in that party, and he should be supported as much as we can. and not just thrown under the bus. And I think Bennett and Lapid are actually navigating that reasonably well, trying to repair some damage that has happened in recent years.
So let's talk about your book now. You've had really a lot of sort of scoops and insider views on the Abraham Accords, and your book is all about changes in the Middle East. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, Enemies and Allies is the first book. It's the only book so far that tells the inside story of how the Abraham Accords came about, why they're significant, and sort of where we might be going next. But it's also the only book that takes readers not into a sort of a general analysis of what the dynamic is in the Middle East 20 years after 9/11, but actually you sit down with the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, as I talk to him on the record with my evangelical colleagues. You come into the palace and you meet Mohammed bin Zayed, the crown prince of the United Arab Emirates, as he tells us 2 years before the Abraham Accords that he is ready to make peace. We were sitting on a scoop. We were dying to tell the world that that's what he told us. But those ground rules at the time were off the record.
Joel,
so we
couldn't say anything. Sorry to interrupt, but why would he tell you that? Right. Like, what is it? I mean, about meeting with evangelicals that this was, if I recall correctly, this was a delegation of American evangelical leaders. You actually are also an Israeli citizen who lives in Jerusalem. So why would he share this information with you guys?
That's a great question, Yaakov. I speculate some in the book, but to be honest, it's not entirely clear. We were the first evangelical delegation ever invited to the UAE. They told us that. He told us that. A few months later, of course, Pope Francis came, and that was a big story. Why did he trust us? Why did he trust us and not think we were going to go leak this story? I'm not sure, except that I think because we had been meeting with King Abdullah in Jordan, doing the same type of thing, President El-Sisi in Egypt, that I'd led the first ever evangelical trip there, these had become big stories also. And he could see that we were keeping confidences. Some things that those men had told us, those leaders had told us, were on the record, and we talked about them. But a lot of it wasn't. And so we were protective. But it is fascinating, right? Because he didn't know us. You know, I'm sure his foreign service and intelligence service had Googled us and vetted us. But nevertheless, it was a big deal that he told us that. And true to his word, he did become the first Arab leader in a quarter of a century to make peace. I think the simplest way to put it is, I think there's a growing sense that evangelicals actually not only love Israel, but we really do love peace, that we're not out there to cause division. It's not a zero sum game. We love both sides. You know, I was pretty outspoken. I think I may have been the only evangelical leader outspoken against annexation last summer, when many analysts thought, well, that Trump and Netanyahu would do annexation for the evangelicals. And I'm like, no, we'd rather see Israel more secure by doing peace deals with the Arab countries. Now, that's because I knew it was possible. And that's why I had more confidence. You asked me 5 years earlier, I might have said, yeah, go grab Judea and Samaria. And someday we'd like to see that happen. And we think biblically it will. But I think that also showed that we have nuance in what we're doing. And we are interested in building a really healthy cooperation between the Arabs and Israel. I hope so.
So the book tells us stories about your meetings, your travels throughout the region, meeting with MBS, meeting with MBZ, and analysis of kind of what direction you see the region going in. So you kind of have met and spent time with a lot of the players behind the Abraham Accords. As we wrap up, what's your forecast for what's happening in the future? We just marked a year to the Accords, that peace deal between Israel and the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and also Sudan normalization. What do you see happening next?
Right. Well, I was just at the one-year anniversary celebration in Washington with Jared Kushner and all the different ambassadors that were involved in the Accords. That was a really special moment. And by the way, I will say again, as a positive on the Biden side, they're finally beginning to go public with their support of the Abraham Accords. They certainly took their own sweet time. But I will say that two things. One, the King of Bahrain has invited us to bring a delegation next year. That invitation had come earlier, but had been delayed twice by COVID. So that'll be very special to honor him and thank him for joining the Abraham Accords. The place to watch, obviously, is Riyadh, Yaakov, and Lahav. I think that the Saudis are actively weighing, is it in their national interest to go full on and make peace with Israel? And what do they want from Israel with regard to the Palestinians as part of the deal? What do they want from the Biden administration? But I think they are warming towards this. And I think if you look at the fact that Netanyahu and our Mossad chief, Yossi Cohen, and Secretary Pompeo met secretly, but I talk about this that in the book, with MBS in the northwest province of Saudi Arabia, in addition to the overflight rights of Israeli planes over Saudi area and the green light and the warm language of supporting the Abraham Accords out of Riyadh. This is very dramatic. And I think it's moving towards a big win. And think about it. This would be the mother of all peace deals. And the Saudis are in the doghouse with Biden. Imagine them giving Biden a big diplomatic win by, you know, effectively seeming to broker this deal. That's be a huge story. And right at a moment when Biden doesn't have any foreign policy wins to show over the next year. Is that possible? It's something to watch, it'll be fun to report on.
Well, that's for sure. Well, Joel, always a pleasure to talk to you. Look out, people, for Joel's new book, Enemies and Allies. You'll be sure to get a good story. Joel's mostly known, I think, right, for your fiction writing.
Right. You've written that's how King Abdullah before. First met me was... I'd written a novel about people trying to kill him, and he read it and invited me to come see him.
And he invited you, if I remember the story, to come watch some like military drill in Jordan, right?
Yeah,
was that what it was or something?
Yeah, my wife and I spent 5 days with him and his senior national security team and generals, and he was basically showing me what he was doing to make sure my books never come true. So
what a story, though. Pretty amazing.
It's in the book.
Yeah, it's all in the book. So check out Enemies and Allies. Joel Rosenberg, thanks for joining the Jerusalem Post podcast.
My pleasure. Chag Sameach.
Thank you for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please send links to your friends. We're available on all major podcast platforms and, of course, on jpost.com. We want to wish all of our listeners a Chag Sameach for the rest of Sukkot and Simchat Torah, and we'll be back here next week.